Joe, could you do me a favor? Could you pick out a song of worship or thanksgiving, maybe a verse or two? And here in a few minutes, about in the middle, I'm going to have you come back up and lead that. Would that be okay? And that's not to keep you awake or anything, but there is a purpose. But just something to do with either worship or thanksgiving. If you would open your Bibles to Psalm chapter 50. Psalm chapter 50. Oil and water do not mix. I am not a chemist, nor do I claim in any way to be one. Don't know all the reasons for that. I think one of the chief reasons has to do with the bipolar nature of the molecules that make up water. One end tends to be a little negative charge, and one end a little bit positive charge, and so as positive and negatives attract each other, they tend to pull together, whereas oil doesn't have those features and so isn't naturally drawn to the water molecules. And because the oil is generally less dense, it usually rises to the top. But you think about things that don't mix. The non-mixture of water and oil is something that we kind of observed in daily life. But it's not necessarily always dangerous. There are other things that can be dangerous. Again, I'm not a chemist, but I've read and have been told that certain things you don't mix. Acetic acid with chromic acid. Acetone with sulfuric and nitric acid mixtures. Acetylene with chlorine and things like that. And some of you who have a medical background may know better than I, or not may, I know you know better than I. My point is, some things just don't go together. Some things just don't mix. And sometimes when we mix the wrong things together, it can be explosive and dangerous. What we're going to think about this morning in Psalm 50 is that we're going to think about two things the psalmist says were being mixed by the children of Israel. Two things that should never be mixed in the religious world. Some of the psalms we look at focus our attention on God. And that's why we've called this series, Through the Psalms, An Awesome God. Because we're looking at the greatness of God. We're going to see that also in this psalm. But many of the psalms, in addition to focusing our attention on God, they challenge us to look in the mirror and to focus our attention on ourselves. And to look at what kind of lives we're living in the presence of this great and awesome God. As we look at Psalm 50, the psalm of worship and wickedness, two things that should not mix, he very simply, basically, has a two-point sermon. He's going to start off with an introduction, and then, having gathered everybody together and gotten their attention, then he's going to look at heart and hypocrite, and then he's going to have his conclusion. So with that in mind, let's begin to look at Psalm 50, the psalm of worship and wickedness. I want to begin by just reading the first six verses. The Mighty One, God, the Lord has spoken and summoned the earth from the rising of the sun to its setting. Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God has shone forth. May our God come and not keep silent. Fire devours him. It is very tempestuous, around him. He summons the heavens above and the earth to judge his people. Gather my godly ones to me, those who have made a covenant with me by sacrifice. And the heavens declare his righteousness, for God himself is judge. What we have here is basically an introduction to the psalm. The emphasis is on the greatness, power, and majesty of God. The emphasis is on a great gathering in the presence of God. The emphasis is also on the covenant that Israel made with God. In fact, that's going to be a consistent theme throughout this particular psalm. I want you to notice there in the first verse, it says, the mighty God, the Lord. At least that's how it's worded in the New American Standard. You have three different words for God that are used back to back to back. The only other place that we find these together are over in the book of Joshua. I believe it's in chapter 22 and verse 22. But you have El, which is translated here as Mighty One, Elohim, which is translated here as God, and then you have the word Yahweh, which is the covenant name for God. It's His name, if you will, that is here translated as Lord. The emphasis is on by, if you read the Apostle Paul, for example, you'll find that Paul likes to pile up words for effect. The piling up of those words is kind of like what we do when we're typing a paper and we highlight or bold or underline something in a paper that we're writing. Or it's how we would put an exclamation point at the end of a sentence. It's really highlighting or emphasizing something. The emphasis from the beginning is upon the greatness of God. He is the Mighty One. He is the Holy One. He is the God of the covenant. And so what he does is say that he has spoken. And you also have an underlying theme here of silence and speaking. The call is going to be here for God to speak. And later God himself in the psalm is going to talk about the fact that he had been silent at times and it had been misinterpreted by people who were living lives outside of his will. But here the emphasis is on the fact that he speaks. It says he summons the earth from the rising of the sun to its setting. That God is coming to Mount Zion. It's a picture of God coming to Jerusalem. God coming to where the temple is located. And as He comes to His place, His holy place, if you will, where you have the Ark of the Covenant and the temple, it says He gathers the earth around about Him. It's as if the earth has been personified, brought to life, made a living being, and has been called to gather around Him. He not only calls the earth, but He summons the heavens, it says in verse 4. In verse 3, it says, fire devours before Him. And this is reminiscent of what you find over in Exodus chapter 19, verses 18 and 19. In Exodus chapter 20 and verse 18. There you have a description of God coming down on Mount Sinai to make a covenant with Israel and to give them the ten, what we know as the Ten Commandments. In those descriptions in Exodus 19 and 20, you have the imagery of God coming, you have the billowing of smoke, fire coming up. It's like the billowing of smoke from a furnace. You have a shaking of the earth. There's tremendous power, so much so that the people were absolutely terrified in the presence of God and said, Moses, you go and talk to God because if we hear Him any longer, we will die. And so in this coming of God here, figuratively on Mount Zion, He comes with that same incredible power and might. And I think it's a play on words and thoughts and memories. Just as God came on Mount Sinai and made a covenant with you, so now God comes again in the same power and glory. But this time He's not coming to make a covenant. This time He is coming to judge those who've not kept the covenant, who've not lived up to the covenant. In Deuteronomy chapter 30 and verse 19, there after re-giving the law to the people, making a new covenant with the people as they're about to go into the promised land, He gives a series of blessings and cursings in Deuteronomy 30. He talks about it, if you keep my laws, these things will happen. If you reject my statutes, these things will happen. And then in verse 19, He says, I call heaven and earth to witness. In other words, I call all the creation figuratively to witness that we have made a covenant together. And that I am your God and I will be with you, but you are called to be faithful to my covenant. And so what God does, the same God who came down on Mount Sinai in the same way, comes again. The same God who called heaven and earth to witness the covenant with Israel, now calls heaven and earth together again. And as He's called heaven and earth together, He's called His people together. His godly ones. His people of the chesed is the word used here. The people of the loving covenant. He calls them together as He had called them together before. But this time it is to judge. Look in verse 6. And the heavens declare His righteousness, for God Himself is judge. The point is, the heavens will witness that what is happening today is righteous and true. The heavens witnessed the original covenant. The heavens witnessed the righteousness and goodness of God. The heavens witness His right to judge His people. And so having gathered all together who were a part of the original covenant, He then is going to speak to the people. In verse 6, "Hear, O people, I will speak. O Israel, I will testify against you. I am God, your God." And let me stop here. What He says there is reminiscent of what He says in Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 and 2, when He is instituting the covenant. Just before He gave the Ten Commandments, He says, "I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt." And so as He's about to judge them based on that covenant, He says, "I am God, your God." Verse 8, "I do not reprove you for your sacrifices, and your burnt offerings are continually before me. I shall take no young bull out of your house, nor male goats out of your folds. For every beast of the forest is mine, and every cattle on a thousand hills. I know every bird of the mountains, and everything that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world is mine and all that it contains. Shall I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of male goats? Offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving and pay your vows to the Most High. Call upon me in the day of trouble, and I shall rescue you, and you shall honor me." His focus here is upon the heart. And He challenges to come and listen to what He has to say, because He's their God, the God who's delivered them in the past, the God who made a covenant with them. And He says, basically, "I'm not correcting you because you offered sacrifices." He says, "Your sacrifices are continually and regularly before me. I'm not telling you you shouldn't offer sacrifices or that you're doing it improperly." The problem goes deeper than that. It's not an outward problem. It's an inward problem of what was going on inside their hearts. And He says, "Let me clarify something about worship." God says, "Worship isn't for me. You don't have anything I need." This is consistent with what Paul says in Acts chapter 17. There's nothing we can give God He doesn't already have. He said, "You know, what do I need your cattle for? What do I need your sheep for? What do I need your goats for?" Because those are the things they sacrifice. Okay, He goes on to say, "The beasts of the forest, they're mine. The cattle on a thousand hills are mine." Now, He's not just saying, you know, that once you get to 1,001, they're not His anymore. He is symbolically and metaphorically using the number 1,000, as we see is used also symbolically in Revelation chapter 20, to say, "It's all mine. So you're giving me what already belongs to me." And He says, "I don't want these sacrifices because I'm hungry. I wouldn't go to your house or your fold or to your farm and pick out some of your sheep or goats because I'm hungry. I don't need that." He says, "If I were hungry, I wouldn't go to you to get something to eat." He says, "You're not making sacrifices because you're doing me a favor." And see, sometimes we get that impression when it comes to worship, that when I'm worshiping, I'm doing something nice for God. Worship is not about God. It's about me. It's about me acknowledging who is in charge of my life. It is about me acknowledging who is the ruler and creator of the universe. It is about me saying thank you to the one who is the source of all I am or all I could ever hope to be. "Shall I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of male goats?" Can you imagine the God of the universe saying, "Man, I'd like a couple of billy goats. I'm short today." It's almost comical the way He's describing it. And so He says, don't go into worship like I've done God some kind of big favor. He says, the fact is, He needs nothing from us. He says, here's what I want from my people. He says, I want people who offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving. I'm reminded of Hebrews 13:15, where there it says, with our lips, let us continually offer a sacrifice of praise to God, a sacrifice of thanksgiving. He says, I want people who really, honestly, sincerely, from their hearts, who are coming before me because they love me, they appreciate me, and they want to express their gratitude to me. They're not giving me something. They're saying thank you for what I've given to them. Number 2, He says, and pay your vows. I want people who do what they say they will do. I want people who are faithful to the covenant they made with me. And then he says, call upon me in the day of trouble and I'll rescue you. He says, I want people who actually trust me, who do more than go through the motions of worship on a Sunday morning, if you will, but who actually trust God when they face troubles on a Monday. He says, that's what I'm after. Keep on doing your sacrifices. That's good, but the problem is not with your sacrifices. The problem is you're just going through the motions. You think you're doing me a favor. You're not keeping your word and you don't trust me. And so he says, when you worship me, then I want you to do it with gratitude. I want you to do it with devotion in which you do what you say you would do in our covenant. And I want you to live lives in which you really, sincerely trust me. Brother Joe, have you got a song picked out? What's your number? 388. As he gets ready to sing that song, I want each of us to sing it differently than maybe we sang the songs when we first got here. Because worship can become habit. Worship can become routine. Worship can be just something we go through and we don't think about what we're doing. So my desire is that as we sing this time, we'll sing with an attitude of gratitude. That we'll sing thinking, Lord, I'm going to be faithful to the commitments I've made to you. And we're going to sing saying, Lord, I'm going to trust you when I face struggle tomorrow. Joe, would you lead us? And sing the noble anthem roar. In verse 16 he says, but to the wicked God says, what right have you to tell of my statutes and to take my covenant in your mouth? For you hate discipline and you cast my words behind you. When you see a thief, you are pleased with him and you associate with adulterers. You let your mouth loose in evil and your tongue frames deceit. And you sit and speak against your brother. You slander your own mother's son. These things you have done and I have kept silent. You thought that I was just like you. I will reprove you and state the case in order before your eyes. Having addressed their heart and focused on the fact that they worshiped God, but their hearts were not right in worship. that they were not committed to God as they should be. They didn't trust God as they should, and they didn't have a sense of gratitude. They saw worship as something they did for God instead of an opportunity to express gratitude for what God had done for them. But in the next section, His judgment becomes more harsh. He's still, I think, talking to God's people because He emphasizes, you have the covenant on your lips. My statutes are coming out of your mouths. You're sounding like you're following me. You say you follow me. Maybe He's referring to the periods when the leaders of the children of Israel would read the law in the presence of the people. But as He describes that, He says, in essence, you sound like you're my people. You look like you're my people, but you don't live like you're my people. The word heathen here is a word He would normally use for those who are outside of a covenant relationship with God. But here, He seems to be describing it, using it to describe His people. And as He talks about them, He says basically, you don't listen to me. You don't accept my guidance and my words and my discipline. My words are on your mouth, but you don't listen to them. You don't follow them. You don't obey them. You don't live them out in the way you live on a daily basis. He says in verse 18, when you see a thief, you're pleased with him. And what happens here in verses 18, 19, and 20 is He is going to allude to the 8th, 7th, and then 9th commandment of the 10 commandments found in Deuteronomy, also found in Exodus chapter 20. And He's going to emphasize, look at these three covenants. He just picks out 3 of the 10 as examples, because the whole focus on this is the fact that they made a covenant with Him. And so what He's doing is He's coming back with the heaven as witness, saying, look, you've broken the covenant. But He doesn't just say you've broken the covenant. He says, let me give you some specific examples. He says, when it comes to stealing, you've broken the covenant. When it comes to adultery, you've broken the covenant. When it comes to how you use your tongue in telling the truth, you've broken the covenant. And so he alludes to what's found there in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy chapter 5. And it's interesting that He not only says that they did these things, but it says that they ran with, befriended those who did these things. In other words, even if they didn't actually do it, they weren't actually a thief. It says when you found a thief, you were pleased to be with him. You were pleased to be one of his friends or his companions. And I'm reminded of what Paul said to the Corinthian brethren, evil communications corrupt good morals. And so the idea is, it was not only about what they did, it's who they ran with, who they were in allegiances with, and who they devoted themselves to. He especially emphasizes with extra effort, the misuse of the tongue, and how the tongue was used to slander others, even their brethren. And I'm reminded of James chapter 3, verse 10, where he talks about the fact that should we, for example, in water, you don't have out of the same spring salt water and regular water. And he said, in the same way in the mouth or life of a Christian, a child of God, we shouldn't say good things about God and then curse His people, or say good person things about a person out of one side of our mouth and then slander them out of the other side of the mouth. In other words, those two things just don't mix. In other words, he says, you come before me and you say you're my people. You say you follow my ways. But you commit adultery, you lie, you steal, you say things to destroy the people who are made in my image. And he says, I've been silent so far in regard to this. Remember, in that introduction it says the Lord speaks. It invites the Lord to come and speak. It invites the Lord to break His silence. And God said, I've been silent up to this point, and you've misconstrued that as evidence that I'm okay with the way you're living. Just because I haven't judged you yet, you're saying, okay, God's like us. He doesn't mind what we're doing because He hasn't said anything about it. You know, it's kind of like if I'm a child, because mom and dad haven't corrected me for this, I assume it must be okay to do it. I'm reminded of what's found over in 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 9 through 11, where some had misinterpreted the fact that Christ had not come back and had not judged the world. Some were saying, hey, He's not going to come. Look, the world has gone on like it has from the beginning. Nothing's changed. God hasn't come yet, so He's not going to come. It was a mistake when Peter talked about it, and it's a mistake when the psalmist talks about it. He says, just because I haven't come in judgment yet doesn't mean I'm not coming. And he says, you misunderstood my silence. But he says, the silence is broken Now I speak, I will reprove you and state the case in order before your eyes. And then in the conclusion, verses 22 and following, he says, now consider this, you who forget God, or I will tear you in pieces and there will be none to deliver. He who offers a sacrifice of thanksgiving honors me, and to him who orders his way aright, I shall show the salvation of God. In the first point of the psalm, he says, when you come to worship, don't just go through the motions. Let us make sure our hearts are right. In the second part, he says, don't worship as hypocrites. Don't go through the proper mode of worship and then walk out and live ungodly lives. He says, we'll face his judgment in verse 22. And he summarizes his points in verse 23. He says, the one who offers a sacrifice of thanksgiving, that's the one who really honors me. Not just the one who goes through the motions, but the one who does it from a heart of gratitude. He says, that's the one that honors me. And back up earlier in verse 5, he says, that's the one I'll rescue. That's the one who has salvation. He also says, the one who orders his way aright, the one who walks in the way of the Lord, lives in the way of the Lord, who doesn't live a hypocritical life, he says, that is the person who shall know God's glory and God's salvation. Would you take out your songbooks and turn to the hymn of encouragement? It's come to my attention when I'm doing some reading that in Mosul, Iraq, 3,000 Christians have had to flee for their lives. That there has always been a problem with how Christians were treated in Muslim communities, at least in that part of the world and in many parts of the world. But apparently it has escalated to the point that it's gone beyond people being ostracized by their families and those kinds of things, which I saw regularly when I was living in Israel for a few months. But it's gone to the point now that people are actually being murdered. They're being killed because they're Christians. Now I want you to think about what they're going through. It was pretty easy for most of us to get here. I mean, maybe you had some car trouble. You know, maybe your alarm didn't go off. Maybe the hot water didn't work and you had to take a cold shower. But really, it wasn't that big a deal for us to get here today. But for some Christians who will gather this week, they will literally risk their lives to get there. For some people this week, they've had to leave their homes and maybe all of their possessions and to go somewhere else to hide just because they believe in Jesus. Now, when they gather on the first day of the week in their time zone to worship, what kind of attitude do you think they have? Because they recognize that they're putting their lives on the line. Do you think they just go through the motions? I don't think they do. And you think on Monday when they're thinking about how they're going to live their lives, realizing that they've made a decision that could get them killed, do you think living right on Monday is going to be taken haphazardly by them? I don't think so. Do we need some persecution? Do we need something to wake us up? Do we need something to take us to a point that we quit just going through the motions, that we act one way on Sunday morning and live another way on Tuesday afternoon or a Saturday night? I hope Psalm 50 challenges us to look at the majesty of God, but then I hope it challenges us to get our mirrors out and take a good long look, not at our faces, but our souls, and say, am I mixing worship and wickedness, or at least worship and apathy? I hope we will have the same level of commitment that those Christians are willing to risk their lives for in the Arab world. What's your relationship with God this morning? If they're willing to die to be in a relationship with God, then what about those of us here this morning who are not Christians? God's not asking you to be shot and killed this morning. He's asking you to walk down this aisle and express your faith in Jesus in repentance, confession, and baptism, and to put on Christ and have your sins washed away. Folks, that's not much. The dying's already been done by Jesus on the cross of Calvary. So what are we waiting for? And for those of us who are Christians, if we look at our lives and realize that we're living hypocrites, that the way we lived this last week isn't consistent with the singing we've done this morning, then God says that He will forgive us if we will come before Him and call on Him in our hour of need. Come and let Him heal as we stand and sing.